Accession number 13359, Mr. George Richardson, reel 19.
Mr. G.S. Richardson, reel 19. How long were you at Cambridge, Mr. Richardson?
Out over Christmas until the spring of 1944. We had one or two leaves, something that we hadn't had for years, and then we moved over to the Norfolk area, Norfolk Broads, the battalion headquarters of 6th Battalion. We're in Alton Broads. We didn't have a lot of line, we had some single duties to do in battalion headquarters, but most of the lines were through the GPO. They were coming direct into our exchange, and so we didn't have many lines to run and maintain. We did get quite a lot of wireless experience and lectures on new procedures that are always changing in up-to-date signalling.
Were you getting any new equipment?
We had all brand new wirelesses issued. They had a long range, around about 12 miles. They were still quite heavy, but they had quite a good covering around so that they could be waterproofed, and you could go out in heavy rain and it didn't get into the circuits like the wirelesses had. So they were quite good. Also, the companies had been issued with platoon wirelesses, and we had to train batmen and company runners how to use radio sets, sergeant major, and company officers, platoon officers. So they all had small wireless sets with a rough handset, something similar to a telephone handset, speaker and receiver in combined in one, compared to ours, which was just a small microphone, served both purposes, and a set of headphones. After our period over at Alton Broad, we were then sent by rail and transport down to just outside of Southampton. We were put into a wooded area called Nightingale Wood. It was part of the Romsey estate of the one of the royal estates. No, what do they call them? Oh dear. Never mind. It was his estate. He's a cousin to the cousin to the royal family. Louis Mountbatten's estate. I've heard. This was an American camp. We didn't have any guard duties. The whole camp was patrolled. The gates were guarded by Americans, fully armed, grenades slung around them, and their job was just to leave us free inside the camp to do what we wish. The first week we were allowed to go out of the camp. We did one or two small route marches, mostly down to neighbouring Southampton Port and back and around the area, just to acquaint ourselves of the Southampton area. But after the first week, we were confined to the camp. We were told that we were not allowed out. Everything in the way of our comforts were inside the camp. There were large cinemas, tented cinemas, large theatres, We had all kinds of American and English stars escorted in and escorted out again. No one was allowed to speak to them. The whole camp was secrecy. It was ringed by barbed wire. We were told that if we tried to go out of the camp, we would be shot. The information that we were being given was of vital importance to the enemy, and the information was given to us every morning. We were paraded platoon by platoon into large huts that were laid out with aerial photographs, up to date, taken by American and Royal Air Force reconnaissance. We were shown huge stretches of what we took to be the French coast. There was no names of any towns or villages, just location names in code. The grid numbers had all been erased, so that we couldn't tell what grids were on, where, which was north, south, east or west. All we could see was huge coastlines and gun emplacements, machine gun posts, barracks, German barracks, and all the rest of it. We also had huge sand maps with a lot of detail of the whole of the sand dunes and approaches to parts of the French coast. So anyone going out and being interrogated, I dare say, with a description of that area, probably German intelligence would know which area it was to be that we were looking at.
Were you being told your own first objectives when you landed, although you didn't have names?
Yes,
of course.
As we were getting closer and closer to what became D-Day, we were given code names, and the beaches that we were told that we were going to be lying had all been given code names, and we were to arrive and land on Gold Beach. We were told that there was going to be a huge bombardment from the sea and the air. Paratroopers would land all along the coast area. Our 149 Brigade were to go in first with the Marines on the left-hand end of Gold Beach, and we were to follow in at 6 o'clock. And our first objective was a place called Candy. And that turned out to be Condé-sur-Sille. Alan Manches was just a little bit to our left. Before we actually started out on D-Day, we had one or two exercises where we marched down and taken on to Landing Craft Infantry. And the Landing Craft Infantry that we were taken on to were all manned by American Navy. They were American Navy. We understood that the Americans were taken on to Royal Navy. And the reason given was, if we were being in on the Royal Navy, we're going to trouble the Royal Navy, would want to stop and fight with us, whereas Americans would dump us and come away. And I think that was a whole point of the main exercise. We, some of our troops were marched down, put onto these ships, and taken along the coast, swung in and out of the Dorset coast, and brought back into Southampton, back into our camp and Nightingale Ward, and then we had one major exercise where the whole of our brigade went down onto LCIs. The whole of the convoy sailed out, Royal Navy, all kinds of transporters. We sailed out into the channel and told that we were going in for an invasion exercise, but there may be enemy there. We had no idea whether we were going to land on French, Belgian or English soil. We had no idea. The places that we were going to land were given similar code names to the Gold Beach and places of entry that we were going to do on eventually on the Normandy coast. We didn't know this. We got up in the morning, and at 6 o'clock we ran in to shore, went down into about 4 foot of water, waded ashore. The Royal Navy were bombarding the coast. We thought we must be going onto enemy territory, because no way would the Royal Navy bombard England. We went ashore. We had a lot of targets, but there was plenty of bangs going off. The English officers and American officers running around throwing grenades and firecrackers, and plenty of noise. And we were diving down every target, and of course I had my wireless, and we were just giving progress reports as we were advancing. We got to positions that had been allocated. Our officers told us to get down and dig in. We did, and everything started coming ashore. Our carriers and stuff like that, wagons, flails, and some light armour. And this all took place all one morning, and round about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, or maybe two, everything is quiet, nobody firing back at us. The guns had stopped. The General Montgomery came ashore with all the chief of staff and our own general and brigadiers, walked around the lines, said, "Well, good show, men. You can go ashore now." And we marched along and over a causeway and onto a place just north of Portsmouth. And we found out it was Helen Island that we had conquered. And there was actually civilians that were passing, and we were asking them, and they wouldn't speak to us. We were asking them where we were, and they wouldn't speak. It wasn't that we were going to the mainland. And somebody had a map of England and said, "Look, that's where we are, Helen Island." So they took us back by transport, one or two. We were there, camped overnight. It was a fine night. We didn't have tents or anything, just slept out in the open, waiting for our transport. And Royal Army Service Corps picked us up. One or two of the lads had managed to sneak down to Portsmouth for the night, and came back in time for our transport to take us back to Nightingale Wood. That was a few days before the actual Duffy started.
What was your role at this time? What were you?
Oh, I was a signal corporal, and had to go ashore with battalion headquarters, with a signal officer and a signal sergeant. The other signals had been sent out to each of the companies with the wirelesses, one signaller and, well, Lance Corporal, usually two signallers, because one signaller had to carry nothing else but spare batteries. We found that constant use of the wirelesses were running the batteries down fairly quick. If we got 2 days out of them, that was about it. So a lot of our equipment had to be carrying spare batteries for the wirelesses. We were still armed. I had a .38 revolver, 24 rounds of ammunition. But everybody that could carry ammo were carrying 200 rounds of general issue, plus two or three bandoliers slung around the neck, and quite a lot of Ben Gunn carrier magazines and such as that, loaded up with hand grenades, although I never carried hand grenades. I don't have to carry a wireless.
What was the morale of the battalion? You'd been brought back from the Middle East.
Yes.
And now you found yourselves in assault.
Yes. Well, I think most of the fighting men, the men that had gone through the Middle East, We were very experienced at war by then. We'd seen just about everything we'd thought. And we thought, well, we've already done one invasion on Sicily, and it was fairly easy. This one's not going to be easy because the Atlantic walls are supposed to be impregnable. They've been shouting that we'll never get ashore. And we fully expected the first few waves of us being mown down. We never expected making inland on D-Day. I never did. I knew that when we were going to be the first troops at 6 o'clock on 6th of June, I didn't expect living through it.
Did some men show resentment to the situation you were in again?
Well, I don't think they dare voice it. Discipline was very strong. And I can't remember the name of our commanding officer at this time. Wasn't English. But our second in command was Ward. And our commanding officer was Lieutenant Colonel Green. And his second in command was Major Watson. Major Ward.
Some of the men, you'd been abroad for 3.5 years, you were back in England, although you'd had some leave.
Yes.
Did some of the men desert when they felt they were so close to their families after being away for so long?
I know that there's quite a few went on leave and didn't return. But the Red Cops soon rounded them up, and of course, they were given a few days' detention. One or two of them that had gone missing were sent even to prison, but not a lot. I don't think there's a lot. And of course, being at battalion headquarters wasn't as bad as being with the forward infantry platoons. And we only mixed with the infantry platoons when we were actually going forward in action. Our job was mostly to correspond between company commanders back to battalion headquarters and between companies, and the company commanders more or less kept our signalers up with his company headquarters. But the company headquarters is always within 100 yards of the forward moving troops, the platoons in front of them. They were never very far behind. Similar to our CO and second command, they were never very far behind the battalion headquarters. This, I think, is a good idea because communications are much better when you're close up rather than being miles apart. And I think it's the whole of our single experience was that the commanding officer was best if he knew exactly what every company and every platoon were doing. And with our new communication system, I think he did get more information than what we had even in Sicily. Although Sicily communications was a lot better than what we'd ever had in the desert.
After Battiscombe and Watson, what was Green like?
Well, we hadn't known him a long time, but as far as I could see, he was a good commanding officer. As far as I know, he was a regular trained Dernlight infantry officer, and everybody accepted him as being a commanding officer. But we knew Major Ward's, and we knew that we could trust him. And we knew he was a fighting man, and I thought the world of him. When we marched down to Southampton Docks, they took us down on the night of the 4th of June, and then they marched us back the same night, around about midnight. The next morning, the march is down again, and we went on the ships. Apparently, the convoy was supposed to set out and was supposed to invade on June the 5th. But because of conditions in the channel, very rough conditions, the invasion had been put off. We eventually sailed on the night of the 5th. The Donars were running up and down the docks, giving last-minute messages to the captains of the ships, and we sailed.
Before I sailed, did you have any visitors of high rank before, in the days before leading up to the invasion?
Well, the general and the brigadiers were coming in, but
royalty or politicians? Not, or
that had happened when we'd arrived back from the Middle East. I've already mentioned about our visit from the 21st Army Group, General Eisenhower. We had General Montgomery. He came and made a well done boys carry on the good work talk with the full 151 Durham Brigade. We've been given the Durham into our 151 Brigade in Sicily. Before then, we'd just been 151 Brigade. We became 151 Durham Brigade because the three battalions had stuck together and worked together well. And we went into France as 151 Durham Brigade. We also had King George VI. He paid a visit. I happened to be guard commander on the gate when he came. And he inspected the guard, and I was surprised to see that he was absolutely lacquered up with powder and paint. I've never seen a man powdered and painted so much. But he spoke, and he didn't stammer at all. He went in and gave a few, had a walk around and saw our brigade and gave a little talk about how well we had done in both the desert and in Sicily. And the only one that we hadn't seen was Churchill.
Did praise from higher people like this have any effect upon you?
No, I think we all, during our campaigns, we've been receiving messages all the time from upper echelons, from our divisional commanders and the army commanders, and it more or less just looked at anything rubbish and threw them away, but most of them I kept as souvenirs. I still have them in my possession. A bit tattered now. On the night of the 5th of June, we set sail out of Southampton Port, and there were some vessels that went out of there. I thought I knew ships because I'd been quite a lot around Sunderland and Newcastle in my pre-war days, and I thought I knew quite a lot about ships, but there was some ships that set sail in our convoy. I hadn't a clue what they were. Nowadays, to look at them, I would have thought they were oil rigs, but I didn't know what an oil rig looked like then. Anyway, they all went out with all the gunboats and everything that we could see. We crossed the channel during the night, and left and right there was Royal Navy, transporters, land and craft infantry, and all night there was Royal Air Force going over, and you could hear it in the distance, bombs going off. Then there was the transporters carrying the gliders and airborne troops, and then came early dawn, the bombardment from the Royal Navy on the coast, our boat run in at 6 o'clock on time. We ran ashore in about 4 foot of water, fully loaded. We managed to wade ashore, and we didn't have much trouble. We were landed on Gold Beach. There were officers on Gold Beach, Royal Marine officers, telling us to get up and over the top and clear the beaches as soon as possible. And we went over into Apple Orchard.
What was, as you touched down, what was the scene to you as you hit that beach?
Oh, just one massive explosions going off left, right and centre. The Germans were firing into our area, but not as much as I expected. I think our initial landings from our 149 Brigade had met much more resistance. The Marines were going in with us on our advance onto the beaches, up the beaches, but there were already marine officers directing us when we landed. And we cleared our area of the beach and didn't lose many casualties from our battalion headquarters.
Did you see bodies and destruction?
Oh, yes, there was quite a lot. There's quite a lot of things that were coming ashore that had been trying to. I think they'd come in some of them before time, such as like tanks and that had hit underwater mines and things like that. They were sunken just off the beaches. I think they were out of time because they were supposed to come in an hour or two after us. By 8 o'clock, most of our battalion were assembled and ready to move off. Our carriers had come in, and I think around about 10 o'clock on the 6th were mobile. I was given the job of escorting Major Woods in his carrier with my wireless. I didn't have another signal with me, just myself. Carriers didn't have a lot. They were loaded up with fuel, and we had one or two and with machine guns on the carrier with Major Woods and the driver. We led our battalion out, and we were making good progress for a few miles. The whole brigade were following us. Major Woods was leading, and we understood, we'd been told, that we had a big objective to take. We'd already got up to Conde Sucelles was 2 or 3 days later. It must have been the second or third day. We encircled Bayeux. Our brigade went round, I'm positive it was the right side of Bayeux, and the 149 brigade had done a similar pincer movement round the other side of Bayeux. We met and we were some miles inland round Bayeux, and our troops were coming in, and following us were artillery. They had come ashore, our own brigade and divisional artillery. Then we started seeing some armour come in, but that wasn't until 2 or 3 days after we got that we saw some of the 7th Armoured Division landing with their tanks.
Did you meet any Germans in this very early stage?
We did, but they were scattered units, and they saw the force that we were coming round in, they were more or less moving. It wasn't until about D-Day 3 that we'd completely encircled Bayeux, and we found out that there was a whole division inside Bayeux of Germans, including a general, around about 20,000 men, and we hadn't even bothered to sort them out. We left that for rear troops to capture Bayeux itself, but we understood that most of them, they knew that they were surrounded and gave up, including the general. And I think most of the divisional troops, divisional headquarters troops, that normally don't do any fighting, they did quite a lot of rounding up prisoners. B echelon troops, they were rounding up prisoners. We were out in front of Bayeux, just waiting for a counterattack. Over to our left, over towards the Caen area, there was hell on. There was a big battle raging. We understood it was a Canadian and one of the British division with the 10th and 11th Battalion DLI in it. I don't know which division that was, but I know the 10th and 11th Battalion DLI, which were offsprings from our division, they were in combat over towards Caen.